an intermediate one between the Vega rocket and Ariane 5. Now they use the Soyuz rocket. What they did is they bought up a whole bunch of these Soyuz rockets from Russia. And they bought them to French Guiana and South America. And they rebuilt them to the way they wanted. You know, it's the equivalent of them buying rockets, bringing it home, and changing everything to their specifications to put certain satellites in space. Really are using the Soyuz rockets. The Russians are involved a little bit with launch, giving them a hand. But last Monday, what they had planned was to launch the first two satellites. What they have planned in the European world is a similar system to what we have, a global positioning satellite system. That's what they want to put up. They're going to call this Galileo. There'll be about 20 to 30 of these satellites that they have planned. 22 scheduled for launch. These were the first two. This is one of these billion-dollar projects. And they want their own GPS system. So they planned this for probably 10 years. These are the first two to be launched, and they launched it by this Soyuz rocket. It got off the launch pad, took off to the proper orbit. They don't go into geosynchronous orbit. They go about 11,000 miles up. And this thing, what happened, got to about 8,000 miles up, nowhere near the proper orbit. And in fact, their inclination was off by about 6 degrees. So what happened is the Soyuz rocket put these two satellites, the first two out of many, into the wrong orbit. It's totally useless. It's not even insured. These rockets are so reliable nowadays. They didn't even insure them. So there's a big investigation going on into what happened. One article I was reading actually came off the space.com talking about this. They said if you were to look at the video of the launch facility in French Guiana, they have a Guiana Space Center, and just like you have 30 or 40 people lined up for a launch with NASA, that's what they have down there. Except it's nothing to do with the United States, it's all them. And they said, what you would have seen is launch took off, and as the Soyuz got to what they believed was proper orbit, everybody cheering and having a good old time, and people started making speeches. They had politicians down there from some of the different countries involved with the ESA. And they said, that's what you would have seen. But in one corner somewhere, you would have seen one guy staring at a screen, not cheering, just staring. He was the one guy that picked this up. He's looking at the telemetry coming back, and he's saying, something's not right here. And the next thing you know, it was reported that these satellites were put in the wrong, useless orbit. So between that, Falcon 9 having a problem last week by SpaceX. Falcon 9 R, the reusable one that they're testing in Texas, in McGregor, Texas. That thing blew up after about 20 or 30 seconds off the launch pad. Some problems going on, including one in Kodiak, Alaska. We have a launch facility down up in Alaska. It's called Kodiak. And the military, the Army was launching a test weapon, a hypersonic test weapon. Anything hypersonic is what they consider over 5 times the speed of sound. Thing got off the launch pad. It was supposed to go out to the Pacific somewhere. And it didn't go 20, 30 seconds, and this thing blew up. So some problems lately in the space world. They have run tests from that launch facility before, back about 3 years ago. They launched one out toward the Kwajalein Tolls out in the middle of the Pacific somewhere, and it worked out good. It hit the target it was supposed to be hitting it, but this one was a failure. So hopefully they get, you know, everybody gets a little bit of luck coming up with Rosetta, and eventually in December you have the launch of the Orion spacecraft from the from Florida on the Delta 4 heavy rocket. That's not going to be the normal rocket for the Orion, but it's good enough for this test to send it out almost 4,000 miles a couple of times around the Earth and to test the heat shield and some of the other new technologies that they have installed on the Orion. Of course, this one's unmanned, but it, you know, it's the first one that could be manned and first test of something like this. 10 times the distance of any manned rated vehicle. So we'll see how that works out. Also in November you have the Maven spacecraft going into orbit around Mars. Hopefully that works out. There's no lander or rover on board that one. They're going to study the upper atmosphere of that planet. So I thought I'd bring those things up. There's one agency that NASA's now involved with, this DARPA. They're releasing some money for NASA to get involved with a company to have a booster. They want to have a booster that could put small, when I say small, about 4,000 or 5,000 pound payloads into orbit. Talked about a little bit about this last week. Dick had brought up a spacecraft, a small shuttle type of thing that NASA wants to get involved with. And sure enough, they picked actually 3 companies, but one of the companies only have 20 or 30 employees, and it's owned by this guy, Dave Mastin, Mastin Space Systems, they call it. And for many years, they've been developing a rocket that would eventually be able to go down to the moon's surface. You know, you'd have a bigger rocket, like maybe the Falcon 9 or something, would get it near the moon, and this company would have a moon lander that would bring a payload of people down to the moon. Well, they chose this company to get involved with the XS-1 project. The XS-1 is the experimental space plane that'll be that NASA wants to develop to put into use to bring up, you know, every day if they want. It would be reusable. Put 4,000 or 5,000 pound payload up, send it into orbit. And one of the reasons they're picking Mastin Space Systems is because of their success rate. They've been launching these things vertically takeoff and vertical landing systems for many years. They've got hundreds of test flights, about 4 or 5 different vehicles, and they think they would have a shot at it. Instead of having a booster take off like on a runway, they want to have this booster with wings on it take off like a rocket, go up to about Mach 10. It would be hypersonic. Wouldn't go into orbit. it would release a package from the cargo area, and that package would have a rocket on there, second stage, which would put this payload into orbit. And they think they would have a shot. Also, Northrop Grumman is another contractor that might be doing this. But it looks like this company, which we really haven't talked about. I've talked about a lot of private companies, but I haven't really talked about Mastin Space Systems. They only have 20 or 30 people. I think they're going to be hiring people real soon. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. And then one last topic I just wanted to talk about before we go back to, back to John, would be the opportunity, the spacecraft rover that's riding around on Mars. You know, we have two of them that are operating now. Spirit is sitting still, but that quit working after about 6 or 7 years of operation. Opportunity is still driving around after 10, going into its 11th year. And, of course, Curiosity, the latest one that's been up there for 2 years now, a little over 2 years. But Opportunity set the record for driving around another planet over 25 miles in a 10-year period. But now it has, some problems. And it has to do with the computer. They have a flash memory on board that's giving them problems. It wants to keep rebooting, and each time it reboots, it takes about 2 days to go through this process, and then a couple of days later, the same thing keeps happening. And what they figured out for a fix would be to essentially reboot the whole flash memory, just get rid of it, anything that's on it, figure out which sectors are bad, which parts of the flash memory can't be used anymore, identify it, and then bring it back up again. They know it, they can do it. They've done it with Spirit many years ago. They haven't done it with Opportunity. But they want to do that to keep this rover going for maybe another couple of more years. It's got a 256 megabytes of flash memory on it. You compare that to the new one, Curiosity. Curiosity has a lot more than that. It's got like 2 gig, about 8 times the amount of flash memory. But, there's a different size and weight of these things. This thing weighs 400 pounds. Curiosity weighs a couple thousand pounds, 2,000 pounds. And there's a big difference in flash memory, but they can reboot this thing. It'll send signals up to it to do that, and they're probably going to do that very shortly to stop this rebooting process that's going on. It keeps keep locking up or whatever it does, and it costs them 2 days every time it happens. It's happened many, many times over the last month. So we'll see how that goes. That's pretty much it. Dick's gone, but John, do you have any comments? Back to you and this WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. And like I said before,
W2AK is on the side here.
Nope. Okay, Casey. John first, see if he has any comments, and then we have another station in there. Go ahead.
KC2WGB. Yes, Paul, one question. On that ship, the Progress ship, I think you said, that's the one that they purposely detonated and exploded because I think it was going off course or there was something wrong. But I also heard that wasn't the normal normal vehicle, that that had had modifications made to it, and that they were testing that. So it's not the proven one that failed. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yeah, well, a couple of months ago, we had the Progress ship launched from Kazakhstan, from Baikonur, Russia put the Soyuz craft, space, Soyuz rocket launched the Progress craft that was supposed to go to the space station a couple of months ago. And that one, they had to detonate. That thing was a failure. So that's completely different than the other one that I was talking about. The one I was talking about, the European Space Agency bought the same rockets, the Soyuz rocket, brought it over to French Guiana to launch their satellites instead of using the Ariane 5 or something like that that they normally use. So we're talking about two different issues, John. Back to you.
Oh, okay, Paul. I was wondering, because I confused those two. Because when I was watching it and they said they had to destroy that, it was a shame. And for some reason, I don't know where that one was going. It was just a couple of weeks ago, but that was it. All right, I believe there was another station in there, so station, come on in. KC2WGB here.
Yeah, this is W2AK, not SpaceX mission. Actually, what happened was an actuation of the, how should I say, the device that blows up the aircraft. The spacecraft, in the event there is a problem, accidentally went off. That was my understanding. I have a nephew who was a former mission control director for them, and that's exactly what I understand had occurred.
Okay, very good. We got a reason. Did you hear anything about that, Paul?
To that rocket. In other words, if there's something that goes that senses that something's wrong, it would blow up. In other words, this thing inadvertently sent something that wasn't wrong and blew up anyway. Is that what you're saying? W2AK, WS2N?
Yeah, W2AK, George. Yeah, that's essentially what happened. And this has happened with occasionally with flights from NASA at Cape Canaveral in the past where they have an abort, and there was no reason to have the abort.
Okay, well, this sounds like a good thing for SpaceX, George. They might be able to, sure, they'll be able to find out why this thing thought something was wrong to detonate it. I know you have the ground controllers, they can abort things, but they do have it automatic. So this thing must have, they'll be able to probably figure out what it was looking for, what it thought failed that didn't fail, and uncross those wires, I guess, George, whatever it is. Back to you.
Yeah, essentially, it launched and they were watching it and everybody was following it at mission control, and all of a sudden, kaboom, and everybody was left with their mouths open, what I understand, and then they tracked it back and they saw what happened.
Okay, very good. Thanks for that. I'm searching, looking for a more definitive answer of what went on. And last week I did say, I wonder if it's going to cost them time with the launch. They had an upcoming launch that was supposed to go up last, a couple of days after that incident. They were launching a private communication spacecraft to a geosynchronous orbit for Asia. They call it Asia 6 satellite. And, SpaceX has all these things on their manifest. And this was one that I thought would probably be delayed, and they did delay it. It hasn't gone off yet. They wanted to look into it. These two rockets that we're talking about, the one that is supposed to launch the satellite to geosynchronous orbit, and the one that blew up are really completely different.
Yeah, that's correct. And they basically they just want to make sure that whatever was involved there, they want to first make absolutely sure of what transpired and see if it applies elsewhere so they can correct it so it doesn't reoccur.
Rocket has 9 Merlin engines, and this one only has 3. And the reason for it is they want to launch from this test facility in Texas, and they want to go up a couple thousand feet and then bring it back down and land it vertically, because that's the ultimate goal for the SpaceX, to have all their flights, when they launch from Florida or they launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base, to go up, put the satellite into orbit, and then have the booster come down and back to where it took off from and land vertically. So none of that was on the Asia 6 flight. They don't even have the landing legs like they've had on some of the other flights to test.
You know, this is old technology. Flash Gordon had that a long time ago.
Isn't that great? Yep. That's why I'm looking forward to it, you know. But I mean, you know, there's been a lot of concepts that have come up. For instance, Buzz Aldrin has this concept of taking the first stage and maybe even the booster rockets that launch the first stage, and have them come down with wings, with wheels, you know, land on a runway. But this guy and a couple of the other ones, Blue Origin, and in fact, this Madison Space System that I mentioned before, they've all been working on vertical takeoff, vertical landing systems, and they're getting pretty good at it. SpaceX had a rocket with one Merlin engine in it, and one of the 9 that normally go into the Falcon 9, and many, many flights in Texas with this smaller rocket, and that's how they first tested their vertical landing, vertical takeoff system. And now they've graduated to the bigger rockets, the Falcon 9, using 3 of their Merlin engines to do the same thing, and they've had a success with that. But now, of course, they've had a failure, and I think a couple of months from now, they were supposed to move to Spaceport America. That's a spaceport that has been recently completed in New Mexico, and renting the facility, you know, paying a monthly bill on it. I think it's cheap too. It's like $9,000 a month to rent this thing. And eventually they plan on bringing this rocket that blew up, the Falcon 9R, to New Mexico and testing it there with it. Instead of being only allowed to go up, you know, 3, 4, maybe 10,000 feet in McGregor, Texas, you know, it's as high as the FAA will allow them to go. In Spaceport America in New Mexico, they'll be allowed to go to 100,000 feet or even higher, and bring their spacecraft back to the landing site. Did you turn it back over to me, Paul? George, did you have any other comments? W2AKWS2N?
Yes, Whiskey 2, Able Kilo Echo. Yeah, the only thing is, I think as time goes by, they will revert to a type of energy that will afford them the capability of anti-gravity. Because, you know, as you said, you know, we're building different types of engines, we're making them more efficient maybe, bigger engines. But I don't think that's the key here. I don't think that's the key to space travel. The real key to space travel is a different form of energy that will give us anti-gravity and will probably use some kind of nuclear resource to project us wherever we want to go, which will not limit us as we are now by fuel sources.
A nuclear rocket planned decades ago. They were going to have, I mean, right from the ground, it was going to launch with some kind of a nuclear blast system, you know. Then it was going to, you know, get into space. They realized that the public wants nothing to do with this. They have a lot of problems. Years ago, I remember when Cassini went up, there was a movement to stop that from going up because that had an RTG on it, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. And the public didn't even want that to go up. And meanwhile, that was a successful flight. It took 7 years. Went into orbit around Saturn in 2004, and it's been operating ever since. Same with all the other deep space missions we've had, Voyager and Pioneer and Ulysses, even Galileo that was going around Jupiter all those years, all were fired by plutonium. So, to have a rocket actually take off using nuclear power, anti-gravity, well, that's on the drawing boards, you know, for a time beyond our time, that's for sure. Definitely beyond mine. Any other comments? Anybody anywhere? This is WS2N.
N2NBR.
UNBR. By the way, George, I got your call letter. W2AKE. I got that right. N2NBR. Go ahead.
Okay, I just wondered, a while ago I heard a rumor to the effect that the Russians weren't going to transport Americans back and forth to the space station because of the current political situation. Is there anything to that? Over to you.
They had one guy from Russia made that comment, and the news media loved it, you know, because he said, you know, with the Ukraine problem going on, America could use a trampoline to get up there. You know, the Russians actually need us more than we need them. If you look at the build of the space station, the operation of it, you know, it's an international space station, but I'm going to say 80%, if not more, is controlled and built by the United States. Of course, the European Space Agency has their piece of it, you know, with Columbus and Japan has their piece called the Kaibo. I mean, we put all the structures up there. We put the solar panels up, and all this stuff is maintained and operated by us. And they really need us more than we need them. Problem is, it's true right now. If they decide to cut us off, it'll be a big mistake for them. They'll never be able to keep the space station going themselves. Politically, it would be a disaster for the space program for them. So, yeah, they talked about the engines. And, you know, I'm sure we've bought some of their engines over the years.
But we rebuild them when we got them, and then we also have the right to and have started to build our own, and they're only for certain rockets to go up. For instance, the United Alliance launch, which is Lockheed and Boeing, they use the Atlas V rocket, you know, to put their all the satellites. Atlas V is, you know, uses the Russian 180 rockets, and they're all souped up and changed, you know, by the United States before they go up, and there is a finite amount of them left. But like I said before, they have the rights to build a, you know, copy and build new ones if they have to, and by the time they run out of the ones that they have, I'm sure they would do that. Also, what is it, Orbital Science, when they launched the Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station, they used the Antari rocket, which also uses the 180s built by Russia. But look at all the other rockets that were used to drop it. The Merlin rockets being built by SpaceX, 100% built in the United States.
W2AK, if I can insert something a little bit off topic before I shut down for the evening.
Go right ahead, JC2W2B.
Last Monday, I went on the air roughly around, let's see, it was around 9:45 to 10:15. And I tuned in a particular repeater, which I normally communicate on, which is in New Haven, Connecticut. I was able to access the repeater. However, I heard people talking who would not respond to me. And so I listened and discovered they were on the same frequency on another repeater and another PL. So I copied the PL and set it up on my rig. And when I spoke to them, I was discovered, lo and behold, I was talking to a repeater based in Maryland, and I was talking to people in Virginia and Maryland and Delaware. And evidently, according to the Tropo maps, the ducting was right on the money for that particular communication that evening. And it's going to occur again September 3rd, 1200 Universal Time. Copy?
Yes, I do. That happens occasionally, and we have people that make some real long-distance communication on 2 meters. Quite unusual. But yeah, the Tropo's right. Yeah, it's wonderful.
And it's going on now, George?
Well, Tuesday, I think it's Tuesday, September 3rd, 1200 Universal Time. I'm looking at the Tropo map, and it's pretty close to the same thing. The frequency of the repeater was 146.64, and their PL was 146.2, and had no problems communicating whatsoever, as if I were a local neighbor, they told me.
Okay, John, do you want to pick it up? I think you're making a repeater better, much better than I am, John. KC2WGBWS.
KC2WGB. Okay, Paul, I only have one more question. I'd like to know, with this consortium of companies we have doing all of these space projects, because we hear nothing on the news, really. You ferret out all this information, and we really hear nothing from the media. What a shame. But I'd like to know, what is the next dream mission they have going with all of this stuff that's going on? Do you have any inkling as to what may be coming up?
Well, as far as NASA goes, you know, the commercial people, they have their end of it. They want to resupply the International Space Station and eventually the Bigelow Space Station. Bigelow is a company in Las Vegas that's building components that are, they're going to have actually a private space station that's going to be big. I mean, if this guy has his way, it'll be as big and roomy as the International Space Station. But as far as NASA goes... Their main objective is to get this SLS, the Space Launch System, going up and running with the Orion spacecraft. It'll be bigger, 10% more powerful than the Saturn V rocket when it launches. And then they have a plan on a heavier launch vehicle that's going to be able to do even 20% more, which means the original rocket will be able to launch three times the amount of payload than the space shuttle was able to put up. And then heavier version, you know, years down the road, will even put up instead of 30 tons, so roughly twice the amount, so you'll be able to launch the equivalent of six times the amount of weight that the shuttle could launch, which means if you decide to put something into deep space, and their next big dream flight will be to around the moon, because they plan on capturing an asteroid with one of these Space Launch System rockets. That will be unmanned. It'll fly out to an asteroid, they'll put one out, capture it, put it into a lunar orbit, and then they're going to send a crew. Up to four people, that's how many the Orion presently is designed to carry, up to four people. They'll fly it out, put it into lunar orbit, have these people go outside, do an EVA, take pictures of the asteroid, bring it back home. That's their next big grandiose mission. But of course, all of this is in preparation to a Mars flight. They want to eventually launch people to Mars. It probably happened in the 1930s. That's the present time frame, the 1930s. Drop it. So that's the ultimate goal. And of course, you'll be able to use the same space launch system to launch heavier payloads to distant planets. For instance, there's a mission on the you know, it's not being funded yet, but they'd like to send a spacecraft to Europa and land on the ice, dig into the ice and all. And you could do that with the Space Launch System. You can launch heavy enough equipment to go there and at a quicker pace. Instead of taking 5 years, you can get there like 2 years, 2.5 years with bigger rockets. Roughly, that's what's going on, John. KC2WG.
Oh, thank you for that info. Wow, there is so much going on, and just trying to stay on top of it must really keep your hands full, for sure. I wish that more of the public was informed of what's going on. You talk to the average person, they think the space program's like dead unless they're shooting something up that's quite available on the news, something drastic happening. They're just not bringing down the nuts and bolts of what's actually going on. Shows you that at one time we had a tremendous interest and now we've lost interest in it. So, all right, is there anybody else out there that has a question for Paul on the SpaceNet?
N2NVR for one more comment.
Go right ahead.
Heard also the sound of from the Soviet era on 20 meters the woodpecker, and I just wondered if anybody else has heard it also. It doesn't have to be at 20 meters, but it could be anywhere. Just curious.
W2AK, if I may interject on that.
Go right ahead.
Has anybody heard of HARP, H-A-A-R-P? That was the Russian version of HARP for many years, and it was around 20 megs and certain other frequencies as well. Copy?
Okay. But I just was wondering what the source was.
Yeah, from what I understand, HARP is being disassembled and sold. What they're going to do with that, I don't know why somebody would buy it, but that seems to have ended. I guess they used that as much as they could. All right, any further questions? This is KC2WGB, the TechNet.
Yeah, it's okay.
Into XJ, go right ahead, Wes.
Okay, just a question. If we apply higher positive voltage near the grounded plate, what would happen? Would the electrons then be pulled from the ground into the positive plate? And to XJ.
Without a schematic of that layout, there's no way to tell. You know, don't know.
There is no schematic. You have a plate that is charge positive, and the other plate is grounded. Would the electron be pulled from the ground to the positive plate?
Okay, you have two plates. One is connected to the ground, and when you put the positive end of a battery to, what's going to happen? I don't think much.
Well, the nature needs a balance. So the electrons from the ground are supposed to be pulled, and eventually you have a balance on two plates of the capacitor.
Not really following your logic on that, Wes. Better save that one for Dick. If you have a battery connected to ground and the positive end is of the battery is connected to a plate, and also on the ground we have a negative plate, you say there's going to be a current flow?
If you have a DC, you're going to have in the process of it, you're going to have you in charge, but the opposite one. The ground is the source of the electrons, so the positive, if we think about a positive, is actually the electrical vacuum. So the clue is that if electrons have a negative charge, so if something is positive, it lacks of the electrons. So the voltage is actually a pair of numbers, not a single reading. So it is the difference between two points in the circuit. So the ground has zero voltage because there is no difference in the number of electrons along any point of ground. And to XJ.
Well, technically, there is a difference in potential between areas on the ground. You know, from one point 100 yards away, another point, yeah, there is a difference of potential in areas. But, all right, let me see if anybody has any questions on this. Otherwise, I'll close the net and we'll go on from there. Okay, nothing heard. This is KC2WGB. Be closing the Mymark TechMech at 10:47. And I want to thank all of you for joining us. And we'll pick it up again next week, 8 o'clock, same channel. And wish you all well. Have a great week. KC2WGB, clear.
Have a good rest of the holiday, John, 73. Dick's out there riding around, 73 to you, Dick, and everybody else. We'll catch you next week. This is WS2N, 73.
Yep, enjoy the rest of the holiday, everybody. Nice talking, 73. This is Whiskey 2 Alpha Kilo Echo, W2AKE, saying good night.
batteries, everyone, and thank you again. And I'll turn it back over to amateur use, this repeater. And let's see if we're going to have a continuation of what's going on here. Wes, over to you if you have something else.
Yeah, I'm going to have a little turn in that question that I have had. So let's say we have a high voltage. That means that there is a great difference in electric potential between two points, representing the values of the voltage. Now, we just give it a plate. We have a certain plate area, so not talking about really 100 feet or whatsoever. We assume that the ground that is, that is connected to one of the plates is even in value, and that would be the negative one. So let me go further with that. So a plate connected to the terminal with a high voltage will attempt to draw the electrons from the ground towards the other plate that is positively charged, because there are different potentials. So now we have interesting situation in static electrics or static electrical charge, because we know that the ground is negative, electrons have negative value, and its plate is positive. And now question to you would be how the cloud is charged when we have a lightning.
Well, you realize in your capacitor that you sort of formed, you have a drift current when you attach that probe to the plate, but once it's charged up, you know, depending on how close the plates are and the relative positions, then it's going to end. Now you're asking about how does static electricity build up on the clouds?
No, I was trying to establish it first, the condition. So one of the conditions is the ground is negative. And the second conclusion that might come up is that we have a cloud, and then we're trying to find the nature of all the lightning. We know that we have electron flow in the lightning strike. How is cloud being charged? Is it positive or is it negative?
I think you can get a cloud to charge in either position. You can have negative clouds or positive clouds. By the event of cloud-to-cloud lightning, I would think that's what's happening.
Would you rather think that you have a negative cloud with respect to the negative charge of the ground? Or would you rather think that you have a negative cloud that is negatively charged with respect to another part of the cloud that is positively charged? But anyhow, the ground is still negatively charged. And you're clear.
Well, you can look at it, you could have two clouds, one charged to, you know, a million volts, another one charged to 100 billion volts. Yeah, one cloud is going to appear more negative than the other, but is it truly a negative cloud? Difference of potential, you'll have lightning between them, but where do you go from there?
If you try to look at the clouds, whatever the charge is, with respect to the ground, would the ground be always negative?
I think it would be fair to make that assumption if you wanted to do that, and cloud-to-cloud lightning, the responsibility would be one less positive than another causing it, where they're always positive compared to Earth. That might be.
If you have a negatively charged place and one is less negative than one than the other, now that would be less negative. That's what you were trying to say?
What I was saying, if one cloud is positive this voltage and another cloud is far in excess of that voltage, the first cloud could be considered negative to the second cloud that I mentioned. That's all I said. And you could have cloud-to-cloud lightning.
Sure.
The Earth could always be negative, possibly, and the clouds could always be positive, if you want to look at it that way. And the difference between two positive clouds, that difference of potential could cause cloud-to-cloud lightning, or we could have cloud-to-ground lightning.
WS2N.
Hey, Paul.
I don't know if you saw that show on Nova about these sprites. They call them sprites. And then the clouds were so negative, so powerful that these things shoot up into space. I don't know if you ever see that show that they had on. It was unbelievable. That was the same kind of thing, but it was like going both ways. You know, like your standard cloud to cloud, like what you were saying, but then also shooting up into outer space, John.
Yeah, Paul, I didn't understand. It appeared that the lightning was striking from the cloud areas in the one that I saw up into space. All right, what is it striking? You know, that was a mystery, and they didn't explain that.
I thought they were saying it was going up into the ionosphere, charging the ionosphere. You know, in other words, that was becoming the other potential. I think that's what it was, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to go back and look at that show. I didn't record it, though.
Okay, because I didn't understand that when they were showing that. I either missed what they said or confused what they said, because I was wondering, it's going up into nothing. It appeared to be nothing. But obviously there's some type of charge that it was transferring to or creating a charge out of something. But it wasn't clear. Not the program I saw. Yeah, those sprites are amazing. And it's amazing how much lightning activity is constantly on the Earth. As you know, when you tune through your low-band radios, you can hear it. And it's a beautiful day here, but you listen to that radio, you'll hear that lightning.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I thought that's maybe what Wesley was getting at, you know, talking about the positive and negative or something, but apparently not. But I think they were trying to show that it was actually charging the ionosphere. But really, that whole show was dedicated to proving that these things existed, you know, trying to get photographs of it. Finally, of course, they did.
Yeah, and the other subject of ball lightning that they covered on the same show that I saw, that was really strange how that happened, and sometimes in groups. Shit, yeah, so much going out there. It's a fascinating subject. Wes?
This is Kenny Stanley. I'm going to go further. The ionosphere is a shell of electrons and electrically charged atoms and molecules that surrounds the Earth, stretching from height of about 50 kilometers, that would be what? Something about 30 miles, 31 miles. Then to more than 1,000 kilometers, which would be over 600 miles. Now, is ionosphere negatively charged, or is positively charged? And then when you have an aurora, is that ionization at negative charge, or is it positive charge?
Well, I believe that the atmosphere itself can exist in both charges, negatives and positives. I think that can go anyway. How exactly? Don't know. Don't pretend to know. But I believe that isolated communities of charges are possible. So I don't go along with, like you're saying, the Earth is always negative compared to the cloud. That's a possibility, but there are differences of potentials up there. So if it's questionable and you say difference of potentials, could we have negative and positive up there? That's quite possible.
So you say that we have a certain number of the free electrons that is sufficient to affect ratio of, say, propagation of positive or negative, right? That's what you say, but we're not talking about electrons now, we're talking about ionized atoms. What is ionization? What is ion? It's unhappy atom that is missing something. Am I right?
I don't know how you would explain that.
How would you explain that?
An unhappy ion, unhappy, whatever you claimed it is. Is it an atom missing something? Is it an atom seeking something? You have to, you know, there's so much to read about that. You can spend a lot of time doing that. Now, once you do understand, are you going to be able to explain the different things that are going on up there? I don't think so, because it's a mix. It's a matrix. I think the whole atmospheric structure is a matrix, and I think different things can exist in different areas, without a doubt.
Well, my explanation for an ion is that ion can be sort of unhappy atom. An ion has a positive, can be positive when they lose one or more electrons, or negative when they gain one of the more electrons. And that's how the ion propulsion is made. And to
exist. Yeah, that's the textbook answer. You know, gains an electron or loses an electron. But there are problems with that because of the restricted occupancy they can have in the atomic structure. So that also has to be taken into effect. It's not that easy.
Yeah, it's interesting. What is ion? Well, that would be an atom or molecule that is electrically charged. So now you say ionosphere is not uniform in nature when it's charged. Entropy.
I believe it's not uniform in nature. I believe it's like a patchwork. Some areas are heavier than others. Thereby, you know, different propagation patterns because of that situation. If it was linearly displaced, it would always be the same. So we have too many variables.
That is a kind of puzzling because we have photons from the sun. It's a pure energy. Now that pure energy is creating ionization, especially in the certain areas. And we have aurora. And now I could see that we have the same charge, but in tridimensional